Generating traffic and sales can be a challenge for online merchants. But selling on the Walmart Marketplace puts your products in front of millions of customers who shop on Walmart.com. And right now, sellers who join Walmart Marketplace can save up to 50% on referral and fulfillment fees for the first 90 days. So get started today. Head over to marketplace.walmart.com/savings. That's marketplace.walmart.com/savings. Welcome to E-Commerce Conversations, a weekly podcast from Practical E-Commerce, hosted by entrepreneur Eric Bandholz.
What is going on, Internet? Eric Bandholz back again with another E-Commerce Conversations. Hope all is going well on the other side of the Internet, on the other side of the table from me,
hey,
Mike.
This is Mike Techu, coming to you live from Beard Brand in Austin, Texas.
Just before we hit record, we're talking about how Mike is always everyone's number one guest.
I don't know about that, but
you made Mike like my top three of the past year.
I feel very honored. Thank you very much, listeners.
So we got you back. A lot's changed since last time we recorded, and we figured we'd give some updates to that.
Yeah, very exciting. Life has been good this last year. You know, 3 years of work, and then you launch it last spring, and you're like, well, I think this is going to work. And then you get a bunch of really great feedback, and you get to solve supply problems instead of demand. And that's always a fun place to be, I think. So it's been very validating this year.
Yeah, there are endless problems with business, and some problems are more fun than other problems.
Yeah.
Scaling down a business are not fun problems, let me tell you.
Yeah, I can imagine that is very true. And I've gone through that myself. You know, everything kind of rides in trends, and you have lofty goals and expectations, and then you try to match or exceed those goals, and then you start dreaming really big, and sometimes you bite off more than you can chew, or you end up going down the wrong path. But I think that's just sort of part of it, right? You have to try a bunch of things and just learn to cut quickly.
I think, you know, it's been really amazing watching what you've built with Momentum from my perspective, because, you know, how far back do we go? Like, it's got to be like a half a decade or something like that.
Maybe longer than that. Maybe almost 10 years. I don't know.
Yeah. You were at that meetup with James Clear, right?
Yes.
Okay. The Ice Bath Man.
We did the Wim Hof. Yeah.
And, you know, so like when I met you, you were kind of like in this, like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to write this love book. I'm going to like.
Right. I was making an algorithm for compatibility, which I did finish. I just never released it.
Yeah. And then you had your cookie company.
That was a couple of years later. That was many years later, I think.
Yeah. You sold your company.
Yeah. We had a bunch of Amazon companies at the time. And it just kind of got to the point. Our best-selling thing was this standing mat, which is like a squishy mat you'd see behind a kitchen or like a hostess stand. And I remember being at a factory and hopping back and forth. We had like 30 of them laid out, all with like 2% differences in softness. And I just remember looking at the owner of the factory, and we just looked at each other like, did you ever think you'd know so much about mats? And I just got like this wave of depression. Like, what the hell am I doing with my life? You know, I mean, it was a great company. I think it was it was the best in the market for the product, but it was just like, is this what I want to be using my energy on right now? And we put the company for sale pretty much right after that. I was like, okay, I think this is as far as I'm going to take this.
So I think what was, from my perspective watching you, what's really interesting is how you gave yourself time and room to like find the right pathway.
Right.
Like, I don't feel like you rushed into the next project. You weren't like, oh, well, I'm going to sell this business, and then this is what I'm going to do now. Like, you gave yourself freedom to explore. Like, during that time period, did you ever feel like angst or just like stir crazy or like just frustrations with not having that very crystal clear direction for what you wanted to do?
Oh, extreme. I think I've figured out in life that the thing that gives me meaning and purpose, a sense of aliveness, is growth. When I am ascending up the hierarchy of needs, social hierarchies, you know, I think that's why those things have been constructed in our culture, is to keep us progressing forward. If you're not busy being born, you're busy dying. And, you know, the thought that we're working towards one day not having to do anything is sort of the American dream, but it's very, very much just not in alignment with human nature. So, you know, I got really good at golf. I read a bunch of books, and I just could not put down this urge to want to solve problems. I'd be in a store and be like, oh, this is an interesting product. I wonder if I can make this. And it was just like this constant thing. I was trying to solve problems and make things. And it was just this resistance I had in myself, like, no, you're retired. You don't have to do anything. And then I got depressed. My girlfriend looked at me differently. I could just see it in her eyes. It was like, who is this loser? I'm like, I'm a millionaire. What are you doing? No, you're not working on anything. You're not growing. And like, oh, I could just feel myself shrinking in all ways. And so about a year into that, I decided I needed to re-embrace the identity of being an entrepreneur as someone who creates something. And that's just who I am. That's like the gifts I've been giving. And so to not use them is sacrilegious at a certain point. So I wanted to use the gifts and the strengths that I had. And now I had the privilege of using them in a way that I wanted and not just to survive or to make money. So I could use them in their highest form. So the angst really happened when I had all of these ideas that would have been great 3, 4, 5 years before that to just meet economical means. But I had created these rules where I was going to do stuff that really moved me, that felt like an inspired purpose and was aligned with a long-term goal. So that was really difficult to say no to a lot of things, to allow myself to become bored. It's just Taoist philosophy that in silence, sound is found. So to allow all that easy opportunity to just wash away and really focus on what is it that makes me feel alive? Where am I actually going? Where can I practice the art of sailing instead of rowing and harness some deeper power? That's what I really wanted to find. So
I remember going on a walk around the Greenbelt with you, and you were talking about sugar. Mm-hmm. And I guess you're exploring sugar at this time. This is like a couple of years before Momentum launched. And you legitimately went on like a 15-minute rant just about like the different kinds of sugar and the sources and, you know, like sweeteners. And, you know, like, I don't think at the time I fully comprehended how much you were working on Momentum, or if you had that vision for Momentum, or yeah, the direction you're going. But I found like your insatiable quest for perfection for a product. So what I see you doing with Momentum, where you've got a product that performs very well and is a great product, but you're still tinkering it.
Oh, yeah. There's that Japanese philosophy of kanai, constant and never-ending improvement, that I think is a really beautiful... The world is constantly changing, and so to make something perfect is sort of impossible, but you can pursue it, which means you're constantly adjusting. So kind of back to the idea of sailing versus rowing. I mean, you're harnessing the natural force in the world to propel you forward instead of shoving your own agenda and ideas and going the direction against maybe the power. When you're doing that, you have to be in constant awareness of where that force is going and then making small, minor adjustments. And the farther you get along, the more clear the destination is, the more attuned to aligning in that precise direction is. So you just gain knowledge, and then you can make better and better decisions on that. So if you're not constantly improving on something, you're not learning, you're not paying attention. So that would be a loss. And plus, it's just when you're really into something, you're constantly growing and you're just perfecting that art. It's becoming a craft. So that's where the joy is for me, is like trying to make something better and better and better.
So from a business perspective, like I understand that, like from a creative perspective, sure, or if it's a hobby or whatever, but from a business perspective, that presents all sorts of issues.
Oh, tons, yeah.
Which you're currently dealing with, and I feel like you've got some unique solutions for. Like, how are you able to tackle, you know, this pursuit of perfection? Because when I hear constant iterations to product, I hear like, you know, all of a sudden I have these old units, mm-hmm, that are no longer sellable because I have the new formulation now, and how do I make the change? And is my manufacturers and my supply chain, is that all going to be able to handle these changes? And then now is this ingredient out? Like, how are you handling the realities of that decision to constantly be changing product. And then also communication to your customers about right. what's changing, where they fall in love with something and then all of a sudden you tweak it and it's an ingredient they no longer like or want.
I think there's a level of trust that you have to develop with the people you're serving, that they know that you have their best interest at heart. And we've definitely run into that, like, oh, the flavor will slightly change. And people are like, did you make this cheaper? Did you make this worse to save money? Like, no, I actually spent more money on it.
That's one of my, like, gets under my skins. Like, yeah. I go into, like, mama bear mode and mm-hmm. I'm like, get a little aggressive. I'm like, no, we're not cutting costs here. Like, we only want to make the best and make things better.
Yeah.
We do make mistakes.
Sure.
But yes, the decision is never about the cost.
Yeah, so I think as long as you are transparent with people and you've communicated that your objective is to figure out how to consistently add more value without raising the cost for the end consumer. So there's a couple things in there. But my general mindset is, how can I make this even more valuable and less expensive? So that's the alignment that I'm working towards. And so I read the Elon Musk biography, like, the second book, biography I read of his back in, August? And it just really hit me that his main insight, he's got this thing called the algorithm that he runs all of his processes through. But 90% of that is happening, you know, boots on the ground in the manufacturing process. So he starts with first principles right from the beginning of something, and he figures out how to make it better for less. And when you really zoom out on what business is beyond like the main tenet of supply and demand, what advantage can you really bring to the market besides making a better product for less? That is business in a nutshell. So like, that's what I want to focus all of my things on, is like, I'm going to make a product that's 10 times better than everybody, but for the same price as everybody else. And then how are they going to compete with me? Most businesses are really just media companies. They're really just marketing platforms. They don't touch the product. They don't have any, you know, the small iterations on stuff. If they're doing anything at all, they're really selling commodities. So I want to make something that is a masterpiece and just stack so much value into it. So the only way to do that, I think, is through owning the manufacturing process. So that's kind of what I've been working on the last 9 months or so. Once the product was validated, people liked the concept, and I saw the path on, like, these are the things I would like to make better. It became very obvious that that wasn't going to happen with a third-party manufacturer. I love the people we're working with right now, but they just can't innovate at the speed that I want. And I can't be there every day, hands-on, like, let's change this by like 2%. I want just a little bit more of this, a little bit less of that. So yeah, there's just a zillion ways to innovate on something, but it's all going to happen at that level, with that level of hands-onness. And when you do that, there's multiple forms of improvement, not just in the product itself, but in cost. So now when I take over the manufacturing, I can cut costs by like 30%, you know, because that was the other guy's margin. I can reduce my cash flow requirements too, or at least the time between manufacturing and being sold. Before, I was like making plans out 6-8 weeks, ordering the product over there, getting on their schedule, getting it shipped to my fulfillment place. And so it just added all this time, and I'm like holding all this cash outside, which restricted the speed of growth at the same time. So I can shrink cash flow windows, I can increase the quantity that we're making, and I can reduce costs, and I can improve quality. So that's what I've been obsessed with the last like 6 months, is how do we do that?
The one thing you can't do with that though is be remote, right? Does that mean you have to be a plant manager, or how does that work? Because like, you're, to me, it's, you have this beautiful business, you have a single SKU, it's doing hundreds of thousands of dollars a month, and you're not touching it. Like, that's right. There is a little bit of beauty in that, right?
Yeah, that is, it's super beautiful, because it really frees me up to find that silence again and work on the next level. The old phrase, don't work in your business, work on your business. That can't change. You have to be on top, looking at the pieces move. So I really consider my job is making decisions. So I try to, every day, I want to have like 1 to 2 hours of hyper-focused thinking, where I analyze what is the most important decision I need to make right now, and then actively work on that. So prioritizing the right thing and then making the right move. And a lot of times it's inaction. It's like, okay, well, there isn't a good decision to make right now, so I'm not going to just find a thing to work on. So just wait. But in that case of, do I need to be in the plant every single day? If that was the case, we would never get better because I would just be executing all the time, which is not a strength of mine. And it's not the best use of my skills. There are people that are way better at it. So I consider everything as building assets. So the manufacturing facility that I've been building out for the last 6 months, that's an asset. So I want to make it so it runs perfectly without me. So that means that's affecting the machines that I'm buying. It's affecting the space and every single decision that goes into that. And it's affecting the team that I'm building to run it. I have all that in mind. Like, this has to run without me or it won't run. So I brought in a great woman. Her name is Rachel. She's been running my other company for the last 2 years, manufacturing things. So I know she's going to be great at it. And
so was she still employed with you or was she in between?
No, she was. So I had this other company where we were making cookies and it was okay. Just sort of like a fun thing. And she's been running it completely for the last 2 years. It hasn't made me money, but it's been an incredible place for her to really develop skills and autonomy. And it's still afloat, much to her testament. And so I just saw that. I was like, okay, she's going to be in charge of manufacturing at Momentum.
Yeah. Are you going to shut down the cookie business?
No. It's like, it's just...
She's going to do both?
Yeah. It's still like just sort of a fun thing. What's great about that is that she's built and trained a team to create food, right? Yeah. So the only difference is now instead of making cookies, she's also going to make this protein shake. And we throw in some cookies once in a while for...
Are they separate businesses or are they lumped under...
I put them all under one LLC.
Okay. So you don't have all the headaches of...
Right. I'm always looking for a path of least resistance on things and to remove complications.
And you're able to do that because they're all your businesses. You don't have any partners.
Right. Yeah.
So you don't have to deal with that hassle. Do you... ever run into the issue of like decision fatigue where there's someone who's not your equal in terms of like decision making abilities that you would want to lean on?
I've gotten very comfortable at Jeff Bezos talks about this a lot. There are decisions that are completely reversible, right? And there are decisions that are not, and they're like big decisions. And so being able to decide which ones of those the decisions are, like I spend a tremendous amount of time on the irreversible ones and almost no time on the reversible. And I have gotten very comfortable at one, instilling, you know, a lot of my thinking into the people I work with. And so they have a pretty good idea. They've watched me make that decision 5, 6, 7, 8 times. And then they kind of know, like, what would Mike do? And I hear them say that a lot, you know, like, well, I just kind of thought about, we had this problem and I thought about what you do here. And then like, we did it and it worked great. Like, wonderful. So I try to think out loud with my people and they're competent and I trust them. So I, you know, it's kind of like, you know, a lot more about raising children than I do, but if you want to create independent people that think for themselves, you eventually have to let them fall and pick themselves up. Right. And my employees are not children. I don't mean to say that, but you know, whenever you're learning something, eventually as a leader, you have to be like, you got this. I believe in you. Let's see you do it. And it's okay if you make a mistake and, you know, I'll be here and we'll fix it. And it was just really beautiful. Last week, I was, you know, going through all the emails and I'm overlooking everything. And usually I'm like, there's 5 or 6 things that I got to like touch up or fix or like give feedback on. And, you know, it's not something I particularly enjoy, but it was just like that day, there was a bunch of questions like, oh, I'm going to have to answer this thing. And I just saw that she had answered it all. And it was brilliant.
Yeah.
And I was like, I just felt so much pride. I was like, oh my God. And then this sort of emptiness at the same time, like, oh, what am I doing? Oh, but it's creating this space that is going to allow me to work on the next thing instead of being busy running.
Yeah.
Now that it's systemized, I can let that go and work on the next asset to build.
I do feel like there's a bit of guilt. I'm going to speak for myself, not on behalf of all entrepreneurs, but a bit of guilt when you exit the execution role.
Tremendous, yeah.
And you go purely into like the strategy decision-making role where it effectively feels like you're not doing anything.
Right.
At all day long. And I think I struggle with it because like my days that I feel like are the best days are where it's like, oh, I cranked out a design or, you know, I came up with an ad or I created a video or something like that where I like, it's almost like if you haven't gotten into entrepreneurship, you almost have to get rid of doing things that you love.
Yeah. Growth is difficult, which is why most people don't or can't do it. And even us, right? Like with the option of staring at a blank canvas or doing the thing that feels familiar and easy and you know you're good at, it's so much easier to dive back into the execution. So I feel that guilt all the time. And I try to check in with my team and like, is there something you need from me? And then like, they're so good. Like, Mike, leave us alone. And I feel guilty. Like I should be, because they're working hard, right? And I feel like I should be in there. But that's what they're good at, is what they really like to do. And I think they appreciate that I trust them to follow through on it. And I think they get a sense of pride too when they do the thing and they're like, how's this? I'm like, ah, man, that's fantastic. Yeah. It makes me feel simultaneously guilty and unneeded. But like I said, you have to create that space, because my job is to, what is the next step? And there's just emptiness in front of us. There's no right path. I have to like imagine it and create it, which is a completely different skill set and process of work. And it just requires a lot of like walking around and reading books and talking to people and just paying attention to where is the force, where is the current, and then how are you going to catch it? So once you get rid of that guilt, it opens a space to do that. I have this frame of thinking I call learn, create, systemize, and it's how I've been able to progress as quickly as possible. I immerse myself in something and I become as close to an expert on it as possible. So you got to see me a couple of years ago when I was deep in the knowledge of, or the attempt at acquiring as much knowledge and perspective on stuff. And then you take knowledge and then you create something. And so you have a thing. That's what I think all products are, right? Is you have this huge amount of knowledge. So for Beard Brand, you know probably everything there is to know about fragrance, about all the materials that go into making a clean product that works well at the same time. And it's taken you years to acquire that knowledge. And instead of trying to teach that to people and like, well, here's how you would create a balm or a beard oil, you have packaged that knowledge and put it into a product. So really what we're always selling in a product is knowledge. And I would say it's more than that, because when I think about wisdom, it's automatic knowledge. You don't have to think about it. It's just there and you implement it. And that is what wisdom is. It's just on tap knowledge. So that's the next step, the systemizing. So you learn something, you create the thing, and then the very next step is to systemize it. And that's when it becomes an asset. That's when it becomes something really, really valuable, is that you don't have to think about it. You don't have to put effort into it. It's just there. It's wise. And it gets you the results that you want. So that's my hope for Momentum, is that I get people emailing in all the time like, oh, could you send me the research on this? I'm like, brother, this took me 40 hours a week for 3 years to put together. I can't just teach it to you. In fact, I can do you one better. You don't have to learn anything. I made a product with all of this knowledge and wisdom built into it. And it's easy and it's in flow with who you are as a human being. And I've thought it all through. You just have to do something that you enjoy. You're welcome.
Well, you have to trust.
Correct. Yeah.
So like, how do you earn that trust?
The way humans work is that they can't trust you directly. And that's probably for a very valid reason.
Well, especially your industry. It's just filled with charlatans.
Completely. Yeah. Which is what attracted me to it, because I saw that there was that void of trust. I wanted to make something that was worthy of it. Now, that said, you still have to overcome that thing. And there really is no way to do it other than to be authentic and actually make a really valuable product that people can try and experience and like, oh, yes, this actually is something good. And then you have to highlight all the things that they've already created trust in, whether it's an understanding of biology, or it's like organic labels, or there are key points that, you know, pillars, stepping stones of trust that they already have. So we kind of detail that out by being as transparent as possible. You know, here's all of our ingredients and at the, you know, where they're from. Here is the third party tests. So those are like elements of trust. And then really we're social creatures at the end of the day. Most people are hearing about Momentum because a friend loved it and recommended it. Nothing I can do will ever be as valuable as that.
Yeah.
Right. So if I can harness that action as much as possible, that's going to overcome that trust, because most people don't and shouldn't trust me or anybody else selling the thing. Like, never ask a barber if you need a haircut, right? Yeah. Of course you do. So yeah, just making sure that your mission is aligned with theirs. So
let's talk about the manufacturing again. You haven't started manufacturing your product yet, or?
No. Hopefully, this is the beginning of February. I'm hoping by the end of March, everybody will have something that we've manufactured.
Walk me through what this is like. If someone is trying to bring manufacturing in-house, what are the pitfalls they need to look for and things to expect, and the wins that you can have as well? I mean, you haven't really hit the wins yet, but...
Right. I think the very first step is a belief structure. I've spent the last 10 years believing that I was not capable of manufacturing, that it was like very complicated and beyond my expertise. But then having spent the last 10 years in factories and seeing who's running them, and I just had to start questioning myself, like, do I really think I can't do what these folks are doing, like intelligent, hardworking people, right? But can I not put a team of intelligent, hardworking people together too? Like, can I not solve these problems? And so I think it really came down to, oh, I'm afraid of being really hard work. That's what it is.
Yeah.
So I just started to question that, like, if I were to do it, would I be doing it like everybody else? And I look at all the evidence in my life, that's not the answer. Most things in life look like really, really hard work, but I have figured out a way to make that not the case. So would this be any different? Like, is there a way to make excellent manufacturing that is easy? I always think those two things are aligned. Hard work is not the answer. Hard work means that you've created a system that needs constant monitoring, which means it's always 1 second away from falling apart. So if you can build something in mind that this is supposed to be simple and scalable, then it's going to be so foundationally so much more secure. So when I'm building this factory out right now, I am thinking 5, 6, 7 years down the road, what are my goals? Okay, I want this to be able to scale up to $100 million. What does that look like in number of units I need to make a day? Okay, so that means I need to be making X amount of units a day. So I need machines that can do that, not at like, you know, breakneck, everyone's working 24 hours a day. I need to think about my team to make sure that they are doing this in a healthy, easy way for them, so they're going to be more likely to execute on it correctly. So I'm buying machines with that goal in mind that make it simple, that are going to reduce the chance for error, because it's you can't completely eliminate errors, but you can remove processes and steps and inputs. So the machines I'm buying should be able to make like 1,000 bags an hour with one employee. That's a really scalable system. I could have made the factory that were required like tons of hands-on work, 10 people to make 1,000 bags every like 3 days. That's like where I think a lot of people would start. So I wanted to think about it differently. And all the machines that I were finding were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. And I was like, well, that's not going to work.
Right. I mean, so like, how much is all this costing? Because you're overbuilding, right?
Yeah, a little bit overbuilding. But when you really zoom out, I am finding the most important machines. And there's really just two. I need a giant mixer to put all these different powders together. And then I need a machine to precisely weigh out and put them in bags as quickly as possible. So there's really two machines that I had to get. And they were both like on the order of $150,000 to $200,000 a piece when I went to a conference where all these manufacturers are at, and they were all American based. And I just started learning about them a ton, and like, okay, so through that, I was able to figure out what machine I actually needed that would fit my needs the best. But they all had like 6 months to a year wait list. So that was another problem. And just I continued learning and learning and learning about it and trying to become an expert as much as possible. And I realized that none of these guys were actually making the machines. They had outsourced the manufacturing to their partners in China.
Yep.
And as soon as I figured that out, I was like, why am I talking to you? There's a value add that they're like, you don't know how to talk to people in China.
Yeah.
That's what they are presuming. Like, oh, yes, I do. I've done that for a decade. So I just, you know, called up their manufacturers in China. And the price.
How did you find that? Just
Alibaba.com. Like,
oh, you just.
Yeah.
And you looked at the photos and they're like, oh, yeah. This looks exactly the same.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, oh, there you go. And I even like, do you manufacture these guys? Yeah. Okay, great.
Yeah. So and a plane ticket's only $2,000.
You do not need to take a plane over.
But
there.
I mean, even the worst cost. Yeah, worst cost.
Yes.
Example.
Exactly. Yeah.
$400,000 of equipment, pay $2,000 and save how much?
Yeah, so the price went from $180,000 for the mixer to $12,000 and a one month lease.
$12,000?
Yeah. So
they have a 10x margin on that?
Well, I mean, there's shipping. The shipping was $5,000, okay. Right? And then, you know, I had to figure out the shipping and whatnot. But, like, is that worth $160,000 or whatever the difference? No. A lot of business is masking the complexity of something to create value. They like the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain, right? Whoa. It's like most things are not that complicated. At the end of the day, most things are not that complicated. If you believe you can figure it out, you will. Sometimes it's not worth it, right? So we get like spoons. We have custom made metal spoons. We buy them for 60 cents. There's no way in hell that it would ever make sense for me to try to go get the delta of margin on that, right? There's just not enough value. But on a massive piece of machinery that I want kind of custom made specifically for what we're doing. So that's worth like my time to become an expert on. Like,
I mean, that's like a year's salary.
Right. Yeah. And so, yeah, I just try to find the highest margin value that I can create and then eliminate the person or the step or whatever it is. So with like the mixing machines, we're getting in the weeds here. We add fat, right? Or vanilla. And the way that manufacturing is that they spray that onto a fiber and that becomes a powder, right? And I pay another company right now to do that. And they do an excellent job, say like with vanilla, right? They take real vanilla beans and then they powderize it. And it sounds super complicated, but when you actually look into it, like, oh, you're spraying a fine mist onto a fiber as it spins. Oh, that's not complicated.
Yeah.
What machine do I need for that? Well, oh, my manufacturer, no problem. Here we go. They added it to the custom mixer. It was like $1,000. And instead of paying 30 times the raw material cost, I can now buy the raw material. I can get beans straight from Madagascar. I can extract them and spray them on there. So I'll be able to reduce that vanilla cost by like 30x. And an employee for $20 an hour will be able to execute that in about 45 minutes, right? So there's a huge delta there of mystery expertise that I'm removing. And Elon talks about this in his algorithm. He calls it the idiot index, right? You know, what is the cost of the raw material? What is the cost that you're paying? What is in that space that is causing that hyperinflation of cost? And it's usually there's a demand supply misbalance or some intern has inserted a bunch of costs that are unnecessary.
Yeah.
So let's just question everything, go right to the cost of the actual raw materials, and then figure out the most efficient, best way to make that thing. And if you can do it yourself, do it. Because that's you're going to save all that money, which means it's going to, now I've removed that cost, and I'm going to do that with like five or six other ingredients. I'll be able to make a higher quality version of the ingredient on demand at like 30 times less cost. So now I have this extra margin. What do I do with it? Well, what Jeff Bezos would do is take all that money and make it even more valuable. You look at like a Prime membership.
Yeah.
It's been basically the same price. Maybe it's gone up $10, $15 over the last decade. But he's added, tripled, quadrupled the value of having a Prime membership. It's the largest membership in the world. It's like 100 million people in America that are Prime members. Because every year it becomes more and more obvious that you'd be an idiot not to be a Prime member, right? So he's just always figuring out how to make the thing more and more valuable. So every amount of savings goes right back in to the customer. So now I've got more margin. So I'm finding new ingredients that I wanted to include, but they were way too expensive and it didn't make sense. Nobody, you know. So the next ingredient we're going to include is colostrum, which people are paying like $1.50 to $2 per serving. And if you add that to a 15 serving bag, like that would add $10 to $15 of cost, right? Or maybe it'd be like $20 of value. Can I add $20 of value to every bag? How much would that cost? Okay, I can go direct to the supplier. There's a guy who has a small farm in Wisconsin that can do this for me, like 40 minutes away from our factory. I've toured the place. It's incredible. It'll be the highest quality colostrum, I think, in the country. It'll be more expensive, but at the volume that we're doing, I can remove 95% of the margin, add it to momentum. It'll be a tremendous value for the customers, and it won't cost them anything more because I found the room to make that happen by taking over manufacturing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's brilliant. Yeah. It's brilliant. You make the decision unquestionable. Like there's just no reason you shouldn't make this buy.
Yeah. So that's part of the improvement stuff.
One of the challenges you'll face in particular with your product is like, oh, it's got this and this and this and this and this. It becomes overwhelming.
Sure.
Like too much information, like they don't understand. Where can people follow you?
MomentumShake.com is where you can go to purchase it. I don't really do much social media, I suppose. You can reach out to Mike at MomentumShake.com if you have any questions. That's probably the best way to get a hold of me.
Yeah.
Momentum.shake Instagram, but we don't really post.
Just buy some stuff. I've been using it for, it's been over a year now.
How you feeling?
I'm still alive.
Nice.
I'll tell you when I'm like, 90 years old, because that's the other brilliance of your product. Won't know till I'm dead.
Well, my hope is that you feel better now. I feel like you always have to have those things aligned, right? You have long-term results for people, but also short-term, so people can know that they're moving in a positive direction. Just to circle back, when you were asking about trust, that's something I think about a lot. Instead of like trying to come up with clever marketing things to convince people, I want to have proof as much as possible. So something that we're doing this year is we're partnering with a company that does clinical trials. So we'll be actually doing clinical trials on Momentum, which is something supplements do not do, right? So we're going to be having our customers be that group, people that want to be part of it. We'll be testing for energy levels, like just through surveys. We'll be doing blood tests. And you can just do before and afters. And you can see with yourself, is this making a difference? And then we're going to be able to combine all that data together and be like, 88% of Momentum users found an increase in energy over 30 days. Or we did sleep monitoring tests and they found this improvement. That to me is how you develop trust, not by just like showing beautiful people in pictures. I get that's part of like the human experience, but I personally want to measure and see results in myself. And I want to see that it happened in other people as well.
Yeah. So a science-based approach to Sweet, Mike. Well, thanks for coming back on the show. This has been another e-commerce conversations. Cheers.
Thanks, brother. I'm excited to be back as always.
Keep on growing.